welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we will be talking a little bit about the BDS movement, a little bit about things happening in Syria, and a little bit about education in the Trump era. But before we can move on, well, everyone knew all sorts of things would be caught by police body cameras when they started being rolled out. Now in Baltimore, footage recently released seems to show an officer filming himself planting drugs. Yeah, you heard me right. A cop recorded himself planting drugs. The footage was released yesterday by the Baltimore Public Defender's Office after prosecutors dropped charges against one of their clients for heroin possession after the police released 47 body camera tapes to them as part of the discovery process of the trial. And the man had been in jail since January, unable to post bond for the charge, which is 50 grand. This is the product of a special unit inside the Public Defender's Office to track police misconduct. It's critically important we remember the context here. Just last year, the Justice Department released a report about the Baltimore police. It stated in a quite detailed way that there was a, quote, pattern in practice, that is, widespread unconstitutional behavior by the Baltimore police. So just to reconfirm here, the Baltimore police have a history and current pattern in practice of routinely, on a large scale, violating the constitutional rights of residents in that city. So it's crucial that we keep that context in mind as we consider this new video of a cop planting evidence, particularly given the police version of events, which is totally absurd. Now, the video itself shows an officer placing a soup can with a plastic bag in a empty lot. The officer then walks to the street and turns on his body cam. He obviously didn't realize it records the last 30 seconds before the camera is technically activated. Now, knowing it's time to perform, he tells his partner he's going to check over here where he had placed the can. He then returns to the lot and picks up the can, which, surprise, has drugs in it. Now, it's 100% clear there that the officer placed that can of drugs, thinking he wasn't on camera, and then tried to record himself finding it as if it had been there all along. That is the definition of planting drugs. But the police are still claiming that it isn't what it seems to be. Now, they've released three additional videos and tried to create an absurd narrative. Their story is more or less a look over here, now look over there, hide the ball sort of thing. They claim that this empty lot is, you know, a place where their drugs have been found before. It's a drug area. There's drug dealing going on. And they claim that they're searching the area because of a guy they had arrested who had bought drugs and this guy who they'd arrested who had drugs on him and that he may have stashed them in this empty lot. I mean, I don't know how that explains this at all. It's just totally absurd. I mean, why would they not just film the drugs with the camera right there when they found them if they found them legitimately? Why on earth would they decide to stage finding them unless they were trying to create a certain perception? Why would prosecutors drop the case if there was such a clear and compelling excuse for why they did this? The story, quite frankly, just doesn't even make the slightest sense as an explanation. And then, of course, there's the context of the Baltimore Police Department that we started with. Clearly and pretty unequivocally, police officers planted evidence to try to get someone convicted of a crime. Don't believe the BPD hype trying to convince you otherwise. As we've detailed pretty significantly on this show, the Voter Fraud Commission being run by Chris Kobach is under intense scrutiny because voter fraud is fake and no one can understand why they would even do this commission other than to push forward voter suppression efforts, in particular because voter suppression is what Kobach is best known for. Allegations that haven't really been helped by Kobach making statements like he recently did to CNN that there was massive voter fraud and that those claiming that there wasn't voter fraud had no evidence. He also said we may never know if Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. So just a string of fake statements. Some people say, well, just investigate. But here's the thing. Voter fraud has been intensely investigated over the past 17 years. Intensely. And there's never been any indication that voter fraud happens in any significant amount. In fact, the amount of voter fraud is infinitesimal. There is literally no evidence that there was any large-scale voter fraud. Again, there is no evidence of large-scale voter fraud. All that exists are random anecdotal statements by people of buses of people being driven into the polls to vote illegally. You know what else there are a lot of anecdotal statements about? Bigfoot. But since, for whatever reason, people can't see through the fact that this is a complete smokescreen for a voter suppression effort, I am now going to go through a huge number of studies that prove that voter fraud is a fake issue. In 2007, the Brennan Center, a think tank at New York University, took a deep dive on the issue. They quote, analyzed purported fraud cited by state and federal courts, multipartisan and bipartisan federal commissions, political party entities, state and local election officials, and authors, journalists, and bloggers. What did they find? Well, they found that the rate of voter fraud in all these cases was between 0.0003% and 0.0025%. Arizona State University has taken a hard look at the issue, even putting together a website to study it over multiple elections. In 2012, they looked at just over 2,000 cases of voter fraud across all 50 states. They found, quote, while some fraud has occurred since 2000, the rate is infinitesimal compared with the 146 million registered voters in that 12-year span. The analysis found only 10 cases of voter impersonation, the only kind of fraud that could be prevented by voter ID at the polls. Close quote. In 2016, the project looked at situations in, quote, Arizona, Ohio, Georgia, Texas, and Kansas, where politicians have expressed concern about voter fraud. What did they find? Well, between 2012 and 2016, quote, attorneys general in those states successfully prosecuted 38 cases. None of those cases prosecuted was for voter impersonation, end quote. So in other words, they found almost no voter fraud of any note and none with fake voters at the polls, despite millions of ballots cast in those states. After the allegations from Trump and Kobach's statements and others that there was a huge amount of voter fraud in this election, three professors at Dartmouth took a look at the 2016 vote. They looked at all sorts of different types of fraud from voter impersonation and non-citizen voters. They looked at county-level data from the American Community Survey, the Centers for Disease Control, and they used a bunch of complex regression analysis, county by county, to try to find patterns in voting. They also compared it to previous elections to try to find patterns in voting that diverge from this population data in a way that could suggest voter fraud. What was their conclusion? Quote, we have not found evidence of massive voter fraud in the 2016 presidential election. A study from Stanford that came out earlier this year looked at potential double votes, the same person voting twice, in the 2012 election, and they came out with 0.02% of all ballots cast in the entire election were double votes. But they then go on to say that when they examined even that small number deeper, it turned out that quote-unquote many of them were not double votes, in fact, but just clerical errors, a point the Brennan Center study also made when it said the vast majority of voter fraud allegations turn out to have other explanations. A study conducted from 2000 to 2014, which examined elections in which over 1 billion ballots were cast, found only 31 alleged incidents of voter fraud. That's just alleged. The American court system seems to feel the same way. In 2016, the Texas Supreme Court noted in one case that there was only 2 convictions for in-person voter fraud out of 20 million votes cast since 2006. The First Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the nation's most conservative, says as it regards North Carolina's voter ID law, quote, state officials failed to identify even a single individual who has ever been charged with committing in-person voter fraud in North Carolina. End quote. The Supreme Court noted in 2007 that in Indiana there is, quote, no evidence of any in-person voter fraud actually occurring in Indiana at any time in its history. I actually could keep going. There are literally multiple studies, perhaps close to a dozen, I did not cite here, that actually do even more analysis on this from a ton of different angles with multiple different research methods examining court cases, voter data, and interviewing voting officials. Over the course of the past few decades, even a Justice Department commission designed to find voter fraud from 2002 to 2005 stated that only 0.00001.3% of ballots cast were fraudulent in the 2002 and 2004 federal election. There is no mass voter fraud. It does not affect elections at all. There is no reason to study it because it has been studied to death. And nowhere, nowhere in the modern history of America where it has ever been alleged has mass voter fraud or any voter fraud that could even come close to changing the outcome of the election has ever been proven true ever. So what is Kobach's plan? It's obvious that he's trying to create a version of his cross-check system of voter suppression that is larger and more robust. It will collect data or wants to collect data from states across a number of different data points, but not every state keeps the same data or keeps the same standards for the upkeep of data. So you get a list full of holes that often counts different people as the same people, and large numbers, potentially up to 3 million last year, are purged from voter rolls illegally. Clearly, Kobach is trying to create a larger version of that database to push forward voter suppression efforts and to create a national climate of fear around voter fraud that backs up voter ID laws. It's political. It's about voter suppression. Mass voter fraud is a myth, period, point blank. And those are today's talking points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined as we switch gears just a touch here by Ben Norton, who's a journalist at Alternet. Ben, thank you so much for joining the show again.
Always glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. And I wanted to start with some news that, I believe it came out yesterday. It might have been a couple days before that, but that is this anti-BDS bill in Congress right now. I mean, it's really like an anti-free speech bill. I mean, it's one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Also amazing how little the people sponsoring it seem to know about it. I was hoping you could shed some light for our listeners on what exactly is moving through Congress here.
Absolutely. This is very, very dangerous, and I'm really glad you're highlighting it. It hasn't got that much attention in large media outlets. Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept and Ryan Grimm published an article on Wednesday looking at the repercussions of this bill that's being proposed. And, you know, as you alluded to, it is really, really draconian. Fortunately, right now, the bill is only just introduced in the Senate. So it hasn't made much traction yet. But the fact that it's even being considered is really, really troubling. So for background, this is a bill. It's called the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, and it was co-sponsored by 44 U.S. senators, proposed by a Democrat, and it has support right now from 15 Democrats and 30 Republicans. So majority Republican support, but it is also a firmly bipartisan piece of legislation. And what this bill would effectively do is make it illegal to support the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, or BDS. For those who don't know, BDS is an international campaign called for by Palestinian civil society and Palestinian labor unions, activists, human rights advocates have proposed this as a way to pressure the Israeli government to abide by international law and to meet its basic legal obligations, namely to end the illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, namely to ensure the right of return for Palestinian refugees, of which there are millions scattered throughout the globe, and also to make sure that Palestinians who are citizens of Israel are guaranteed equal rights. So the BDS campaign has been growing rapidly throughout the world, and the Israeli government has been terrified. The Israeli government, in fact, created its own department devoted to countering the global boycott movement. And in the U.S., we've seen correspondent action being taken against the BDS campaign by state and now federal officials. So I live in New York, and here Governor Cuomo recently passed an executive order because the local legislature was not able to push through anti-BDS legislation. So instead, the governor did by fiat. And what's happening now is this legislation has reached the federal level, and the Senate has proposed legislation that would not only make it illegal for, quote, U.S. persons, that's the way they're talking about it, not only for U.S. persons to support BDS, they also are making this punishable by a minimum of a $250,000 fee and up to 20 years in prison. And let me repeat that. According to this new legislation that was proposed, not only is supporting BDS illegal, but it is punishable by a minimum fee of $250,000 and up to 20 years in prison. So this is an extreme piece of legislation that is, I would argue, one of the most intense, extreme attacks on civil liberties and basic democratic rights that we've seen in the U.S. in decades. It's very chilling and very, very concerning.
Yes. I mean, it really is unbelievable. And it just, I mean, equally unbelievable to see that, you know, people signing on to stuff that they don't even know what it is, basically, just because they want to show their fealty to the pro-Israel positions that are so popular with certain subsets of people. And it seems like it comes at an interesting time where BDS is just becoming more and more of an issue. There's also Radiohead, I think, has played now this concert that people were getting them to not play in Israel. I mean, it does seem that this is becoming more and more of a pivot point here in this discussion, more so than maybe, you know, negotiations or this, that, and the third, is the success of the BDS movement in really raising this issue. Your thoughts?
No, of course. The BDS campaign has been the most effective modern campaign to pressure Israel to abide by international law. And that's why Palestinians called for it. And again, it's important to stress, this is not something that was created in Western capitals. It was called for by Palestinian leaders themselves. So when you have, you know, musicians like Thom Yorke of Radiohead, who not only vehemently opposed the protests, but actively antagonized pro-Palestinian solidarity activists, Thom Yorke actually, you know, gave the middle finger to activists at his concert recently in the UK. So, I mean, seeing the ways in which they're antagonizing these Palestinian solidarity activists is really, really concerning. But it actually, it's only, you know, frankly, one small part of these much larger problems. You know, the fact that we're even considering this at a legal level means it's really reached a whole new, you know, world. It's one thing for musicians and artists to refuse, you know, and to refuse to abide by the boycott of Israel for Palestinian human rights. It's another thing for governments to illegalize it. The American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, in fact, released a statement on Wednesday coming out vehemently against this new Senate bill and stating explicitly that it violates the First Amendment and free speech. You know, boycotts are a protected form of free speech. And in terms of the efficacy of, you know, the boycott movement, of course, the BDS movement is modeled after a previous very successful international boycott movement that directed against apartheid in South Africa. And famously, Desmond Tutu, the South African anti-apartheid leader, who has also been an outspoken supporter of Palestinian human rights, he explicitly said that that the situation in Palestine is very similar, if not worse, than it was than the situation he faced in apartheid South Africa. And Desmond Tutu is a staunch supporter of boycotting Israel on behalf of Palestinian human rights. So looking at the historical echoes of this, it is very, very troubling. Of course, there was bipartisan support among both corporate parties in the U.S. for apartheid in South Africa, just as today there is bipartisan support for apartheid in Israel and for Israel's periodic wars in which it kills thousands of Palestinians, and for Israel's illegal occupation, which just this June saw its 50th anniversary. And the BDS campaign is, of course, a response to that. And it is growing, and especially in other countries, in parts of Europe and in Latin America, BDS has been remarkably successful. And we've seen large divestments that have been, you know, reached, and even here in the U.S. with some universities and churches and other institutions. And that's why Israel is so vehemently opposed to BDS, and that is why pro-Israel groups like AIPAC are working and lobbying with U.S. politicians to write legislation like this. And, of course, AIPAC was involved in drafting this recent draconian anti-BDS legislation in the U.S. It really is reflective of the fact that Israel's actions are no longer in any way defendable. And instead of trying to rationally defend them, because it's impossible, politicians have resorted to these draconian tactics.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think that's 100% clear. We are going to take a break on that note here. We're going to come back with more with Ben Norton and discuss a lot of other very important issues here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perdue, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around you. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are continuing our conversation here with Ben Norton, who is a journalist at Alternet, and we had just left off talking a little bit about developments in Israel and Palestine and around the BDS movement. And I wanted to shift gears a little bit here, Ben, to another huge blockbuster story in some ways, I thought, yesterday, although it kind of was in and out of the news. President Trump deciding to end, or at least saying that they will end, the funding of the quote-unquote anti-Assad rebels inside of Syria. Pretty big news. Your thoughts on that announcement?
Well, we shall see. I am skeptical, of course. This is not the first time that the Trump administration has claimed that it was going to stop supporting rebels inside Syria. In fact, right after he entered office, his administration claimed that. And then there are reports that it was still arming rebels anyway, especially in Idlib. I think Trump himself probably opposes this, but Trump himself has handed over much of his foreign policy authority to very hawkish generals, and gladly at that. I mean, Trump does not have an anti-war bone in his body. I'm very skeptical of these reports. However, if they are true, I think this should be something that is actually, celebrated. The U.S. has for years supported rebel groups, many of which have been allied with al-Qaeda, and tried to destabilize a government in the heart of the Middle East, fueling this war that has gone on needlessly for years and resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. The U.S. has played a key role in not stopping, but in rather further fueling and prolonging the war in Syria. And any steps we can take to do the opposite, to move toward peace and a resolution of the violent conflict, I think should be welcomed. Also, we need to be talking about who these actual rebels are. You know, the media reports in the Washington Post and elsewhere talking about CIA support for rebels typically avoided mentioning what those rebels actually are. And we hear nonstop in media outlets from both liberal interventionists and neoconservatives and, people who are from the Democratic and Republican parties alike talk about so-called moderate rebels and the moderate opposition and pro-democratic forces. These forces have very little impact on the ground inside Syria. The two most powerful rebel groups in the country are rebranded Syrian al-Qaeda, which is now known as Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and the other group is an extremist Salafi group known as Ahrar al-Sham. Those are the two largest, most powerful rebel groups in Syria. And we can talk all day about the CIA supporting 50 people in some brigade in Daraa in the south, but they are not going to have any impact on this conflict. They're not going to actively win any battles. All they're going to do is continue prolonging the conflict, bleeding the Syrian government and its allies, and leading to needless civilian casualties. So to summarize here, I am skeptical of the notion that the CIA is no longer going to support rebels inside Syria. That said, if it is true, this is a very rare welcome development. In an otherwise administration that has been full of hawks and bombings and airstrikes and raids. So, maybe in some ways this could be a slightly positive sign.
Well, and even the way that the Post spun it, which was to make it really try to make it more about Russia, interestingly enough, at least in the headline, the way they put it, which tells you a lot. It just seemed to me to be part of this continued, and this is just relevant to your sort of last piece there about who these rebels really are, this kind of conspiracy of silence around that. Because to me, the real story there is if they're saying they're ending it, is like that not only was this a failed program based on their own metric, but that the results of it were so catastrophic and who they funded and so on and so forth, whether Russia will like it or not is relevant, but certainly not a headline issue. But I wanted to just keep on this general issue of who the rebels are and this idea that there's a sub-conspiracy of silence in this country around that, because I know that you just recently did a piece with Max Blumenthal about this guy, Bilal Abdul Karim, who I think many people have probably seen on the internet doing videos on YouTube and the like from a lot of these quote-unquote rebel-held areas working with CNN, not exactly who many people were making him out to be, at least from my vantage point.
There is no substantive discussion of what the actual forces are on the ground in Syria. And, you know, I get constantly smeared in response to this. I don't know how many times I have to repeat myself. Yes, the Syrian government has committed horrific crimes in this war. The Syrian government has a lot of problems. And I'm not just saying that you know, Bashar al-Assad has committed no crimes and has no problems internally and is not, you know, has not carried out ruthless actions. That is all absolutely true. But we're constantly hit over the head with that fact. And what is ignored is that the opposition to the Syrian government is dominated by al-Qaeda and similar extremist groups. That is the reality of the situation on the ground. Anyone who is a serious analyst recognizes that. Even hardline war hawks like Charles Lister, who works for Gulf-funded think tanks in Washington, D.C., and who has lobbied for years for U.S.-led regime change in Syria, have acknowledged this basic fact. The last remaining rebel-held province in Syria is Idlib. Idlib is controlled by rebranded al-Qaeda. We're not allowed to discuss this, and the media outlets almost never acknowledge this very basic fact, which you can't understand the conflict without knowing, which is why they don't mention it. Because if you don't mention it, then you can frame it in a particular way that is conducive to U.S. government interests. Joshua Landis, a leading American professor who, unlike many of the pundits in the media, has studied Syria for years, who lived in Syria for several years, he wrote an article in Foreign Affairs magazine, which is a very centrist, middle-of-the-road, respectable foreign policy journal, in which he talked about the reality inside rebel-held Idlib in Syria, where posters of Osama bin Laden are on the walls, where Salafi extremist graffiti is on the walls saying that democracy is anti-Islam, saying that Shia need to be destroyed. And again, not only are these groups extremists, but they're genocidal against Muslim minority groups, especially against Shia, which are globally about 15% of Muslims. And Joshua Landis also talks about the fact that ethnic and religious minority groups inside Idlib and other rebel-held territories have been ethnically cleansed by these extremists. So there's constant fixation in the media on the crimes of the Syrian government, but very little acknowledgement of the crimes, yet alone of the identity of these extremist groups that have been backed by not just the U.S. and the CIA, but by U.S. allies in particular, especially Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which had for years supported many of these al-Qaeda-linked groups, including ISIS. And a 2014 email from Hillary Clinton acknowledges that Saudi Arabia and Qatar both supported ISIS. So instead of talking about these basic facts, we get all of this moral preening and these platitudes about, you know, the Assad regime, et cetera, and we're not allowed to get a particularly insightful, nuanced understanding of what's happening. So then when Trump says that he's ending the CIA program, you have people in the self-professed liberal resistance against Trump who are smearing this as a campaign that was launched by Russia. This is so preposterous. The notion that Trump is being Putin's puppet by ending support for al-Qaeda-linked extremists, I mean, it's just so preposterous that it's hard to even know where to begin rebuking this, because it's not based in facts. It is sheer fantasy. It is sheer anti-Russian warmongering. I mean, many pundits in the U.S. media have explicitly called for the U.S. to continue arming these al-Qaeda-linked groups in order to undermine Russia. In fact, I mean, I'll just end with one little segment here, and this is a really important tidbit to highlight. This is how incredibly delusional so many people in Washington have become. Thomas Friedman, one of the leading columnists for the U.S. newspaper of record, for the New York Times, he published an op-ed several weeks ago openly stating that the U.S. should support ISIS inside Syria in order to undermine Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah. That's the incredible phase we've gotten to, where so-called liberal resistance figures against Trump are literally calling for allying with a genocidal group that has mass murdered thousands of innocent civilians in order to undermine U.S. enemies.
Wow. That's... seems like an awkward shifting of gears. I mean, that's just such an unbelievable statement. It's hard to know what to say. But I don't know if this is going to be on a brighter note, but at least perhaps. One of the issues you and I talk about a lot, Ben, is Yemen. Last week, some interesting votes in Congress there in the House to limit significantly U.S. cooperation with the war in Yemen. I thought that was relatively interesting. I mean, who knows? It's got to go through the Senate, you know, whatever. It may never go anywhere. But just the fact that there seem to be a growing number of congressmen who want to speak on this issue, I think it's relevant for a couple reasons. But one reason is we know Congress people don't do anything unless they hear about it, which has to also reflect that the war being waged there and the U.S. involvement in it is just more and more people must be becoming outraged by it and saying something if these people feel compelled to back things to limit the U.S. role. But your thoughts?
No, it's of course very, very welcome. And it's a very positive development. And what was great about this is it was bipartisan. It was both Republicans and Democrats who traditionally are holding hands in their support for U.S. wars. So, of course, this is a welcome development. Like you said, whether or not it will get through the Senate is another thing. In fact, several weeks ago, the Senate just voted against a piece of legislation that would have blocked a sale of $510 million of precision-guided missiles to Saudi Arabia. And that legislation was voted down 53-47. Five Democrats sided with Republicans to vote that down, effectively in support of arming Saudi Arabia. So the House has some more dissenting voices, but unfortunately, I'm skeptical of the notion that it could get through the Senate. But again, regardless, as you mentioned, you know, if anything, this is mostly a symbolic measure, and the symbolism is still incredibly important. This is a conflict that has gotten very little attention. It has been going on for 28 months now, and it has finally, in the past few months, especially with the election of Trump, become somewhat of an issue in mainstream media, and it has gotten some more attention. But even then, this is partially because things are spiraling out of control. In Yemen right now, not only is there the worst food crisis in the world, with 17 million people going hungry, with 7 million people on the verge of famine, like almost to the point where they're going to die from starvation. And many people have died of starvation. We're talking about mass numbers, but not just the hunger. There has recently been a horrific cholera outbreak. There are now well over 330,000 cases of cholera, about 1,800 deaths. And that number keeps growing daily. And in fact, the United Nations recently announced that it was canceling its vaccination program in Yemen against cholera because the UN has, a major lack of funding right now. So while the Trump administration is boasting of cutting funding for the United Nations, and while the Trump administration is simultaneously ramping up its war in Yemen, the World Health Organization is halting its efforts against cholera while thousands of people are dying. So, yes, this is a very important development. And the fact that any U.S. politicians are actively going against the White House and the national security state is amazing. And that is something that we should support. And I don't want to be pessimistic. I mean, there is, of course, a possibility that this could go through the Senate and people could pressure their representatives in the Senate to vote for the legislation. But we should, you know, at the same time, be pretty realistic and understand that although this is a welcome development, there's still bipartisan support for this war.
Well, you know, this comes on the heels of another sort of interesting development there in Congress, which was the issue of the authorization of the use of military force issue, the need for a new one, I guess, or revisiting the original one from 2001, the Barbalese bill. passing through, actually succeeding there. Your thoughts on that as well, another sort of interesting piece.
No, this is amazing. And in fact, Barbara Lee is very commendable. I mean, like, what she does is remarkable. And she has for years been speaking out against the contract that lawmakers have given the federal government for a perpetual war. And she has said this, and it's not hyperbole. The AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, is effectively a contract for perpetual war. And any attempt to either rewrite or even potentially remove that is, I think, something that should be applauded. The AUMF has been cited repeatedly, even in recent years, to justify wars throughout the Middle East and South Asia, even though this is 2001 legislation. This is 9/11 era legislation. 16 years later, it's being used, for instance, to justify the bombing of Syria. Recently, in April, the U.S. government bombed a Syrian government airbase at Shaydat Air Base. And this was likely illegal under international law. The U.S. has not officially declared war against Syria. And when the Pentagon was asked what legal authority, this was just about legal authority in terms of U.S. law. When the Pentagon was asked what justified that airstrike, the Pentagon cited the AUMF. Again, this is 9/11 era 2001 legislation. So, yes, anything we can do to put limits on the White House's ability to wage war, especially when a far-right extremist like Trump is in office, is very welcome. And I think we should all applaud Barbara Lee for her efforts.
Do you think it's fair to say, with all these sort of issues popping up the way they are, the Yemen piece, the authorization of use of military force piece, I mean, it's maybe at a low level, but that there's sort of a return of anti-war politics to the political discussion in a way it hasn't been in some time?
Oh, I think for sure. And, of course, unfortunately, a lot of that is just partisan. We now have not just a Republican, but an extreme Republican in office. So it's very easy for people to now oppose war. But, yeah, I think we are seeing a slow, gradual resurgence of the anti-war movement. And that is something that is welcomed and should be cultivated. And I think it's also something that we need to consider even more seriously, because Trump has only been in office for several months. For about half a year now, and he still has 3.5 more years in which there is no doubt he will be waging even more wars. So the more we can build up an anti-war movement now against many of these wars that Trump is continuing from the Obama era, I think the better state will be in when he begins launching new wars of his own.
Yeah, which is almost sort of bound to happen. I mean, I'm curious, what's your read of Trump so far, foreign policy-wise overall? I mean, you and I talked about this a lot in the lead-up about how, you know, he was making so many contradictory statements while trying to hold himself out as somewhat anti-war. I mean, what's your, you know, sort of quick capsule view of maybe where that stands now from, you know, maybe what we thought in, like, you know, mid-2016?
Yeah, well, frankly, I mean, I don't think my views have actually changed that much since then. I pointed out a lot when we were talking about this during the presidential campaign that Trump would sometimes flirt with anti-interventionist rhetoric, but at the same time, he would constantly undercut that with boasts of how he would kill the families of extremists, how he would bomb the hell out of ISIS, etc., how he would go above and beyond what Obama did. And I think that's what we're seeing. I think we're seeing the same contradictions. We see Trump, for certain issues, express some kind of anti-interventionist sentiment. And I say anti-interventionist, not imperialist, because Trump is a diehard U.S. imperialist. He strongly believes in empire, but he thinks that there are more strategic ways to cultivate empire. And sometimes that involves bombing the hell out of countries like Iraq and Syria, and other times it means collaborating. So when it comes to the issue of Russia, Trump doesn't want to declare a war on Russia, whereas, you know, it looks more and more like many people in both the liberal and conservative side of the U.S. spectrum would be fine with a catastrophic war between the U.S. and Russia. So that is one change. However, I think is frankly somewhat mild compared to the extreme policies Trump has pursued. And not only has continued from Obama, but has ramped up. So the war in Yemen, Trump has ramped up. the escalation of aggression against Iran in particular. Trump has made anti-Iran sentiment the, you know, key plank of his foreign policy. The increasing aggression against North Korea, Venezuela. Yeah, I mean, it is true that in some ways, especially on the issue of Russia and Syria, Trump has diverged a bit from the foreign policy consensus. But in the other ways, which I would argue are even more dangerous, especially when it comes to the threats against North Korea.
More or less the same deal. Absolutely. Well, I appreciate it. Ben Norton, journalist at Alternet. Definitely check out everything that he's doing. We're going to take another break here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about education in the Trump era, and I think we have a perfect panel to discuss that, and we'll see what else we may even get to, because very distinguished group we have with us, Frank Lara, who's an activist in San Francisco with the Answer Coalition, also active member of the teachers union out there and an elementary school teacher, and Josh Harris, who's the founder of Holland's Creative Placemaking, also does a lot of educational pieces, and he was the 2016 Green Party candidate for mayor of Baltimore, as listeners of this show will know quite well. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start with an issue that I think is very interesting and sort of very relevant, and coming from Baltimore City, of course, and San Francisco, which even though has a reputation as being very gentrified in education, still dealing with a lot of the issues of most inner city school systems. And I wanted to start with this issue of Rahm Emanuel's new thing in Chicago, which is this graduation requirement where you have to have a job, be joining the military, or have a college acceptance letter if you are going to officially be certified from graduation for high school. So, you know, very controversial because it hits at the root of one of the biggest pieces of quote-unquote urban education, which is this sort of personal responsibility element of it. So, you know, Josh, I'll start with you. I mean, not so much on Chicago itself, unless you want to speak about it, but just this overall issue of adding these sort of hurdles on, which I think is something we sort of hear sort of put out there a lot in a lot of inner city school systems is, oh, we need to have to hold kids to higher expectations, so on and so forth. So anyway, Josh Harris, your thoughts on all that?
Absolutely. I mean, so I have been doing a little bit of research on this, and I'm from Chicago originally.
Mm.
So understanding the plight in Chicago is something that I'm very familiar with. Also knowing that youth unemployment rate is extremely high in Chicago. And so we're expecting kids to now be prepared for the real world, but there's no opportunities for employment even while they're in high school. And so that's been one of the hurdles or barriers, I believe, in Chicago when it comes to reducing violent crime. There's just a lack of opportunity for employment. Then I think it's been as high as like 37% unemployment rate in the African-American community. So that's something that has to be addressed. I think that the idea of it, what he's trying to do is, it is a good idea or thought in theory that we want to ensure that kids are prepared and that they're going off to do something. But it's a whole nother hurdle to make sure that we're providing them with the opportunity to be prepared to even take those steps, right? So now you have some people who are making it just to even get to the fact of being able to graduate high school, and they've made it through that, through the conditions that they deal with at home and beyond. And now you may be saying that you won't even be able to do that because you don't have a plan beyond. What does that say to someone about the value of even wanting to get to high school graduation? How are we making sure that we're not just taking someone's accomplishment and saying it's not enough, right? And that's something that we have to be, that has to be very well thought out about and planned out appropriately. I think that it's great, or it would be great if this were something where you were in very privileged or more well-off communities where kids had opportunities and knew and had families and people who were telling them what they could do and what their options were, but that's not necessarily the case. This is going to drastically affect or disproportionately affect low-income black and brown communities, right? Who in some cases may not know what their options are. That's something that needs to be evaluated further.
Absolutely. Frank, Laura, also, you know, you have a lot of experience in education here. Your thoughts on this sort of this particular move and maybe sort of the broader sort of maybe philosophical, ideological implications of it?
There are two things. One is how you view the current conditions in the social conditions, economic conditions that particularly our most oppressed students face in the public school system. And then the other component, too, is sort of the political and what realm Emmanuel, particularly the Democrats, represent to our movement to be able to resist this. On one end, it's like, what is the current context that this is being presented, right? Chicago, large school, the union fought really hard to build a network of community organizations to fight back for its rights and for also for quality education. And at a national level, we're talking about 52% of students in our public school systems are actually under the poverty line. If you think about that, like 52% is a huge number in the richest country in the world. Just other facts, you know, only 76% of Latino students graduate. 67% of black students actually graduate from high school. You know, they're almost two times more likely to be poor. Children of color are to be poorer than white children. So when you have that social context, when you talk about social, like individual responsibility, it completely negates the fact that public schools have been completely defunded. The children's lives and their families have been completely defunded. And so now you're turning into this personal responsibility. And also the fact that college has exponentially grown. So now that students have, you know, anywhere from $50,000 to $60,000 in debt and is not really an option for folks. So that's the context that these types of laws are going in. And we already know that there's an informal draft, poverty draft, that's been implemented throughout the country where, you know, because you have no other option to succeed in life, you go into the military for the hopes of trying to get some opportunity. So I think that's a cruel way of Rahm Emanuel to present this program. But more importantly, it's like Rahm Emanuel was a symbol, I think, of what is establishment Democrats. But really, what is the Democratic Party? Because you have the case again, what did sometimes now we talk about Betsy DeVos and the struggle against her policies. But if we look at the administration, Obama's administration and Arne Duncan, how much he also led the charge for privatization, charter schools that devastated communities throughout the country, it's only obvious that someone like Rahm Emanuel would take up the torch to fight against the teachers union, fight against the community, and promote this privatization.
Well, you know, I think that's a good, it raises a good point. I'm curious your thoughts on it, Josh, because I think the AFT convention, I think, starts today, and they're making a big point of opposing DeVos. And it's a weird piece because on the national level, a lot of times Democrats are critical of people like Betsy DeVos, but I think we see, certainly in D.C., where I am without any doubt at all, they are the number one promoters of a lot of similar policies. And it's an interesting, I don't know if it is a paradox, but it's interesting. So your thoughts?
I just pulled up, actually, statistics from Chicago Tribune. And it says that of the 77 communities or areas with the highest homicides, a third of those come from five communities. And those five communities have joblessness rates for teens between 79 and 92%, and 70% for young adults as, in general. So the greater question is, as Rahm Emanuel looks to try to create some way to make sure that teens have required to graduate, what are we doing to make sure that they have job opportunities? Before graduation, they're being prepared for the real world, right? What are we doing to develop and bring jobs to those areas? I tell people all the time that Chicago is one of the most segregated cities in the world, right? They took what we did here in Baltimore around redlining, and they said, we can do it and we can do it better. And that's exactly what we've seen, and we see those issues perpetuated to this day with the lack of investment, lack of job opportunities and options for black and brown communities. And you asked me a specific question, and can you repeat it for me so that I can actually answer that question?
Yeah. I appreciate that. That's excellent background as well for, I think, people to know and to consider. And I was just sort of raising the issue, subsidiary issue here about sort of the interesting convergence, perhaps. Frank had mentioned the issue of privatization between some of the critique you see from Democrats on the national level of school choice type policies, a lot of what Betsy DeVos is saying, but then on the local level, and I was mentioning D.C. here for sure is a good example of this, but also many other cities, New York, Chicago, of a lot of basically the same policies as what DeVos is talking about, what she wants to do in overhauling the school system. And it just seemed like a very interesting sort of paradox to me there.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think we all know that we're moving towards the privatization of education system, and it's the direction that is this very slippery slope. School choice, what is that? I often ask that question, because who chooses to send their child to a bad school? No one does, right? And not all schools can be the best. And so it's this kind of false argument that people are putting forth. And it is amazing that we're seeing a lot of that played on the local level, and that we're not seeing as much of an uproar about it as we should. And it's something that I've had several debates with people that I consider friends who were proponents of school choice. And it's something that we have to definitely be aware of. And it started, it's definitely starting in places like Chicago, where we saw one of Rahm Emanuel's first things when he got elected was he closed hundreds of schools in Chicago, right? Cutting off access to education to many people in communities that now have to travel all the way across the city through gang violence and all sorts of things to simply get to a building where they can be educated at, right? What does that mean if they don't have the ability to get to and from? What are the implications on their ability to be able to advance their education now just in the K-12 system? And so we've definitely seen these steps being taken by mayors like Rahm Emanuel all over the country. We've seen now too, in Baltimore, although we're slightly different with public charters, we've seen those buildings that now have been vacated now be purchased by private companies and private schools or charter schools being opened up in them, right? Now providing access, and then we're seeing a stronger crackdown on public school systems, which are now in jeopardy of closing as well. So there's a lot of wheel spinning that we definitely have to be aware of in cities all across the country, and Betsy DeVos is only speaking to what we're seeing, a reflection of the tap that's been happening locally for the last few years.
Good points for sure. And, you know, one thing I was also thinking about, Frank, that's very relevant in our discussion of education, I was thinking completely randomly about civics as a topic. Because the way I think we teach government and civics is interesting, and what really sparked this conversation in my own mind was Colin Kaepernick doing these Know Your Rights trainings and like going all over the place doing these Know Your Rights trainings. Great. I'm all for it 100%. And then I just thought to myself, you know what's crazy is like, why is this happening? Like, why does like a professional athlete have to spend his own money to like go around the country and teach black and brown students like what they need to prepare for in terms of the real world? I mean, that's what people always say, oh, we're preparing students for the real world. And these types of things often aren't really, I don't know, maybe there's some schools somewhere that are doing it, and shout out to you if you are. But that kind of conversation around what it really means to engage sometimes, I don't know, just like you have officer friendly in the school or whatever. So I just sort of kicked the I don't know what the question is there, but this overall issue here of what we're teaching kids and what curriculums are and what's in there also seems relevant to me. And it seems like we've lost a lot of that conversation in the broader conversation, which is very important, of how our schools are structured.
I think there's just multiple levels to that. And I think it's difficult to address because it changes. It varies so much on the school and an institutional level. I mean, if we pull at the institutional level, right, our schools are really not meant to educate, to liberate. I mean, they're institutions that are meant to provide sort of basic foundation for people to be prepared to different levels of the economy. And so from that level, you can't expect really, if the civic engagement looks like an election for Trump, and that's at a mass scale, I think that benefits those who got him elected. Because, and you know, at a local level, I work at a school that is known for, we had a march a week after Trump was elected, and that was in response against fear, building a community. It was a very unique case, but we did it. We teach a lot of civics, but that's a personal choice, right? And you could argue that the Common Core, again, another institution imposed on schools, that does offer some flexibility on that. So it's a contradiction, and I think it varies to school. What's more, I think, relevant and important is that we're seeing through the economic development of neoliberalism that there isn't a real need to develop an educated workforce. And so if that's the trajectory, if you're having the rise of most of the jobs after the crash of 2008 be retail jobs, be low income, no benefits, the destruction of unions, the, you know, export of an industry in the U.S. and most of the rise in wealth in this country has been through the military industrial complex, through technologies that don't really require, again, like not a massive education of a workforce. then the trajectory fits to where the education system is going today. So I think that the broader issue for those of us who are active and involved in our union and want to actually bring justice to the education system, we have to answer those tough questions. I think Josh was raising up the contradictions in that a lot of us grew up in this public education system and, you know, don't like it. And we're faced with racist institutions. We're faced with racist educators. And so that contradiction, there is a frustration, right, that gets generalized. Maybe you had a personal experience that was great, but that isn't the voice that's being heard. We often, when we organize against this idea of unaccountable charter schools, we hear that on a broader scale, people say nationally schools are bad. But when you talk to them on an individual level and say, how's your school? Oh, I love my school. I feel safe and this and that. But you don't hear that because the national dialogue has been created to fit really a particular pattern. People obviously face frustrations because they send their kids there. It's their livelihood. But that's a political movement created by forces who want to sell an alternative. And I think the contradiction that we have to mend is that yes, currently the public school system is failing a lot of our Black and Brown students. But the alternative to that, the trajectory is really towards this privatization. In the case of, you know, we just have Louisiana, I don't know if you know, but at the time it was 92%, just like maybe 5 years ago and after the destruction and even before that. Now it's 100% charter schools. And just came out that none of those schools are actually doing anything different and are even failing at a worse level than the public school system. It's not to say we shouldn't be sad, like we shouldn't fight for a public education system, but that has to look a certain way. And we have to build allyship within our communities, the unions, and those fighting for quality, good, stable, safe education for our families.
Josh, your thoughts on the same question?
Yeah, no, he brought up a really good point. I mean, our schools, as he said, are not teaching to liberate students. It's just, there's so many different factors that we have to consider that students in urban areas in the city have to deal with that don't exist necessarily in suburban areas, right? And so how are we making sure that we're not just teaching to the test and continuously putting systems in place to just test you out, but aren't preparing you for the real life of the workforce? We have to make sure that our education system, our K-12 system, is producing students and sending them out to the world to be prepared for what they're going to encounter, to be prepared to understand what civics is, to be prepared to understand the voting process and electoral process, to be prepared to know what a credit score is and why you shouldn't just take those credit cards that you get mailed to you immediately as soon as you turn 18 and what it's going to mean if you do it and you don't have a way to pay them all off. There's so many things that are not included because it doesn't fit the testing curriculum. And so we have to figure out a way to balance our education system to better prepare our young people to be liberated, if you will, upon and have the opportunity to really get that leg up and have the opportunity to thrive versus just surviving after they graduate high school.
No, I think that's it's a good point, and it raises maybe one of the most difficult issues around education, which is that intelligence is really not quantifiable in a lot of ways. Like, there's a lot, I think everyone knows that there's a lot of different types of intelligence. There's a lot of different, there's people who aren't quote unquote book smart who are very savvy. You know what I mean? Like, there's just different ways that the mind works. And I always think that that's a challenge that we have, is this overall issue that we're looking for. Well, how do we quantify exactly that this person, da 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 da, when I mean, a lot of getting through life is critical thinking skills and how to navigate issues that you didn't expect, so much as, like, you know, remembering how to do long division, which is very relevant and important, maybe to keeping your finances together. That's important. You should learn it. You should do it. Just like what you said, Josh, how do you encounter the thing that the credit cards, where you didn't learn, you know, what that was? So, you know, a lot of different issues that are all jumbled up here that I think that's always, to me, the most important thing is, how do we give people those critical thinking skills that are out there? So go ahead, Josh.
And when we look at overseas models and what they're doing in their education system, they are teaching their young people to be critical thinkers, not just to the test. And they also, I mean, the education system, for the most part, is free, even higher education in many places. And so with the advancement of technological advancements, this should be the direction that we should be moving, and we should have the capability to do that. With technology at our fingertips, it should become more affordable to make sure that our students are being provided with the best opportunities to be educated.
Absolutely. Well, Josh Harris, Frank Lara, thank you both so much for joining us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. We are out of time here today, but we will be back tomorrow. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. See you next time.
By Any Means Necessary.